Inside Florida Politics, the essential podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from the part-time playground of President Donald Trump and New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hiya, George.
Well, right there, you've already got a borderline unsafe carnival ride of talent, but we're going to overload the thing this week because we've got in studio here a very special guest, award-winning Palm Beach Post staff writer, Christine Stapleton.
Hello, George.
All right. Well, let's get this thing started. You know, even when President Donald Trump isn't visiting Mar-a-Lago, Palm Beach County always seems to find a way to make national news. Since our last podcast, the aforementioned Robert Kraft and two dozen other men were charged with soliciting prostitution at a Jupiter massage parlor that authorities say was connected to a Chinese human trafficking ring. Of course, there's a political angle to this story, and that's what Christine Stapleton is here to talk about in a little bit. Also, there's been no shortage of hot takes on former Trump attorney Michael Cohen's testimony on Capitol Hill this week. But here on the podcast, we're going to dissect the Florida-related material, including Cohen's new claim about Florida man Roger Stone and some potential trouble ahead for Congressman Matt Gaetz, the panhandle Republican who's one of Trump's top allies in Washington. And in addition to all that, John Kennedy is going to give us a preview of the 60-day legislative session that's coming up in Tallahassee. But first, I believe I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music playing. There it is. Listeners of the podcast know when you hear that music, it means it's time for our pick a number segment. That's the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and then later on we explain what that number means in Florida politics. John Kennedy, why don't you go first? What's your number?
George, I'm coming in big this week with 1,338.
1,338 for John Kennedy. And as always, we encourage podcast listeners to take notes as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. So you want to put next to John Kennedy's name 1,338 for John Kennedy. Zach Anderson, what's your number this week?
I'm going to go a lot lower than that one. I'm going to throw out a 5 here, George.
5 for Zach Anderson. Elegant prime number. Christine Stapleton, very special guest.
Right in between, I'm going to go with number 43.
All right. Christine Stapleton has brought a number 43 to the podcast. And George Bennett, that's me. My number is going to be 0. I know there's been some debate about whether 0 is a number, and we have ruled that for purposes of the podcast, 0 is a number, and that's my number this week. So my number again, George Bennett, 0. Zach Anderson with a number 5. Christine Stapleton with a 43. And John Kennedy way off the grid there with a 1,338. You want to hang on to those numbers and find out at the end of the podcast what they mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our very loaded lineup this week. While the New England Patriots were making their historic run toward a 6th Super Bowl championship a few weeks ago, police say the team's owner, billionaire Robert Kraft, was making a couple runs of his own via his chauffeur-driven Bentley from his part-time home in Palm Beach to a massage parlor in a strip shopping center in Jupiter. It's there that prosecutors allege that Kraft and others paid for sexual acts. Now, Kraft, we should note, has denied doing anything illegal. And this is more than just a story about a rich guy getting busted in a prostitution sting, though. Authorities say the spa that Kraft visited was connected to an international human trafficking operation. And that we should also point out, though, that at least as we record this podcast, no actual charges related to human trafficking have been filed yet. And the reason we're talking about all this on the politics podcast, though, is that the Florida legislature is about to convene, and there are no fewer than 6 bills that have been filed related to human trafficking. And that's what Christine Stapleton is here for. She's going to tell us about some of these bills. But before she goes, as is our custom, all guests on the podcast are welcome with our royalty-free surf music. Sounds a little like Dick Dale's Miserloo, but it's a royalty-free offering there. So, Christine, tell us a little bit about some of these bills in Tallahassee related to human trafficking.
Okay, so we've got about four that are going to be particularly controversial. We've got House Bill 219 and Senate Bill 370 filed by some Martin County lawmakers. And what that would do would require Johns that are convicted of soliciting sex from victims of sex trafficking, require them to serve 30 days behind bars. Now, right now, those crimes are misdemeanors and are generally resolved with sentences that don't involve jail. And the issue with the 30-day sentence that could pose some problems is the crime of sex trafficking has to be proven before these men can be eligible for that 30-day sentence.
Right. So as we mentioned, for example, Dave Ehrenberg, the Palm Beach County State Attorney here, and William Snyder, the Sheriff of Martin County, have both said publicly that these that some of these operations are connected to human trafficking. And yet, at least so far, they have not brought any charges. It sounds like it would be a difficult level of proof to charge somebody with something like that. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. The men right now, like Kraft, have been charged with soliciting a prostitute, a misdemeanor. Now, under this new bill, the prosecutors would have to prove that human trafficking occurred. In order to do that, they'd have to charge someone with human trafficking. And those are very complex cases and time-consuming. Those are first-degree felonies. And those can often drag on for years, whereas your misdemeanor prostitution charge, those are often resolved very quickly. And the people charged with those, they have a right to have that resolved quickly. So
speedy trial.
Speedy trial, yes. And so the problem is, how do you charge or sentence someone to 30 days in jail for having sex with a victim of sex trafficking if you have not proven the crime of sex trafficking?
Good question. When does that ever stop lawmakers from passing something, though? But yeah, that's a very good question. As I mentioned, Dave Ehrenberg is the state attorney, the top prosecutor here in Palm Beach County. He's also a former state legislator, so he knows a little bit about crafting legislation. What has he said about all this?
Well, he told me yesterday that he is actually going up to Tallahassee for the first week of the session, and he's already been in contact with Representative Toby Overdorf, who's the sponsor of the House bill, and Senator Gail Harrell about how they can rework this bill and get around this this judicial issue they have.
Okay, so there's that bill. Basically, then instead of this misdemeanor where at least the first time offenders usually don't do any kind of time, that bill would have them serve 30 days, right? You said?
Yes, that would be a 30-day sentence that judges could sentence them to.
What's some other legislation that's in the pipeline?
Okay, so Senator Lauren Book has proposed a bill that is actually a three-pronged bill, but one element of it is particularly controversial. Her bill would require the establishment of a registry, kind of like the registry there is right now for sexual predators and sexual offenders. Mm-hmm. And the registry, you know, that sounds maybe like a good idea on paper, but one of the problems and the hurdles that I'm sure that civil libertarians are going to be upset about is her bill says that you don't necessarily have to be convicted of a solicitation charge. Say, for instance, you're arrested, you're put on probation, you successfully complete probation, and the judge says, okay, I'm not going to find you guilty. You did what you're supposed to do. Under Book's bill, she would still require those Johns to be registered. And that is going to cause, I'm sure, some problems with some defense attorneys and civil libertarians.
Wow. Now, these bills were all filed before this Robert Kraft thing happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, John Kennedy, as a seasoned veteran of Tallahassee, I mean, human trafficking is not a new issue. These bills were filed. But from your experience, a high profile case like these arrests down here, does that have an effect on legislators in Tallahassee?
Yeah. Oh, I think it does. It can drive stuff. I mean, legislators sometimes act very similarly to script writers for episodes of Law and Order. You know, they'll take an issue that's in the headlines and just run with it. But there may be some added momentum this year to, you know, toughening penalties for wrongdoing that seems linked to human trafficking. But, you know, the other thing is that any effort to require jail time, it sort of clangs into other efforts that are being promoted around here that are aimed at easing the state's crowded prison system, basically right. Reducing sentences for offenders that are seen as, you know, convicted of nonviolent drug or property crime. So how that might fit into this where, you know, you're dealing with what, you know, many might see as low level sex offenses, you know, how that fits into this. That's another question.
Sure. Christine.
Yeah. And I think adding to that, John, to the momentum is we have an unprecedented number of women now in the Florida legislature. We had an election in November, and now we have nearly 30% of the legislature's women. So the lawmakers that I spoke with yesterday about these bills are saying, you know, the recent headlines coupled with this new legislature could mean that we see some traction, these bills getting some traction this year.
And, you know, one other thing I wanted to address, and Christine, you can address this. John, you mentioned prostitution is soliciting prostitution is traditionally seen as a low level kind of offense. And people sometimes will say prostitution is a victimless crime between consenting adults. But Christine, just to make the trafficking, explain a little bit about what's involved with trafficking and why it doesn't really fit into the traditional maybe view of prostitution.
Yes, I mean, in terms of the consent issue, the women allegedly in this case were being held against their will, and their passports were taken from them, and they were basically forced to perform the sex acts in order to stay in the country. They were some of them were sleeping in the day spas, and so you really don't have that consent element because these women are being held captive. They don't have passports, and they are at the mercy of the traffickers.
Okay, interesting issue. So, and you know, more as Christine explained, a little more complicated than it might seem on the surface in terms of pursuing legislation. Although, as she mentioned, Dave Ehrenberg is a former legislator. He's going to be in Tallahassee working on this issue. And another guy that's a key figure in this to watch is the Martin County Sheriff, William Snyder. And he's also a former state lawmaker. Christine?
Yeah. And, you know, Snyder's interesting in this whole thing because Sheriff Snyder, he is very outspoken. And he told me, he said, I'm taking every media opportunity I have. He's been on CNN. He's been on NPR. He's been interviewed by the Daily Beast, and he will go so far as to use, you know, really colorful language, calls the Johns cockroaches, calls them monsters. And so he's really fueling the, you know, the publicity that's driving this effort too.
Yeah. So you'll probably see a lot of and hear a lot from Martin County Sheriff William Snyder in the weeks and months ahead as this progresses. But well, let's move on to another big Florida story. Michael Cohen's testimony before the House Oversight Committee this week. And there's plenty of material in there, but we want to focus here on the podcast on just some of the Florida stuff. Probably the biggest Florida related thing was, and this was new, some of the stuff Cohen said had been said before or leaked out before, but you know, here he was kind of organizing it all in one thing under oath on national TV. But one of the things that was new was his claim that Roger Stone, the longtime Donald Trump advisor going back to the 1980s, and Roger Stone, of course, is a Florida man, lives in Fort Lauderdale. Cohen claimed that he heard a speakerphone conversation in July 2016 in which Roger Stone told then-candidate Donald Trump that WikiLeaks was about to make a massive dump of emails that would be damaging to Hillary Clinton. Now, Roger Stone denied that this happened, and President Trump has denied in the past, he has denied having any conversations with Roger Stone about WikiLeaks. So, but we'll have to see how that plays out. Now, there's two Floridians on the Oversight Committee. One of them is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and a Democrat from Broward County. And you may recall Debbie Wasserman Schultz used to be the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee. And she basically was the first casualty of the WikiLeaks hack shortly after the first big batch of those emails came out in July 2016. It included some emails that showed the people on the DNC seeming to favor Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. There was a big uproar over it. And just before the Democratic National Convention began in Philadelphia in 2016, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was pressured to resign as DNC chairwoman. Well, so here Debbie Wasserman Schultz got an opportunity to question Michael Cohen during the House oversight hearing. And I want to play a couple of clips from that. First, she asks him a little bit about the Roger Stone accusation.
Based on your experience with the president and knowledge of his relationship with Mr. Stone, do you have reason to believe that the president explicitly or implicitly authorized Mr. Stone to make contact with WikiLeaks and to indicate the campaign's interest in the strategic release of these illegally hacked materials?
I'm not aware of that.
Was Mr. Stone a free agent reporting back to the president what he had done, or was he an agent of the campaign acting on behalf of the president and with his apparent authority?
No, he was a free agent.
A free agent that was reporting back to the president what he had done.
Correct. He frequently reached out to Mr. Trump, and Mr. Trump was very happy to take his calls. It was free service.
Roger Stone says he never spoke with Mr. Trump about WikiLeaks. How can we corroborate what you are saying?
I don't know, but I suspect that the special counsel's office and other government agencies have the information that you're seeking.
Okay, that's interesting there. And Zach is going to talk in a little bit about the other Floridian on this committee, Republican Greg Stube. But Republicans throughout this hearing sought to undermine Cohen's credibility. Although if you listen to what he said there, I mean, aside from this allegation about Stone, he also, though, is not really directly tying Stone to necessarily to any kind of conspiracy or collusion, other than just saying that he called Trump and told him these emails were going to be coming out. I want to play another clip, though, of Debbie Wasserman Schultz questioning Cohen and really pushing on the collusion question, which in his prepared remarks, Cohen said that he, did not have actual evidence of collusion, but he suspected that there might have been. But so here's Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida pressing Cohen on the collusion angle.
The campaign and the entire Trump organization appeared to be filthy with Russian contact. There are Russian business contacts. There are campaign Russian contact. There are lies about all of those contacts. And then we have Roger Stone informing the president just before the Democratic National Convention that WikiLeaks was going to drop documents in the public arena that we knew at that point were hacked and stolen by Russia from the Democratic National Committee.
The gentle lady's time has expired. May answer her inquiry.
My question is, quickly, given all those connections, is it likely that Donald Trump was fully aware and had every intent of working with Russia to help make sure that he could win the presidency at all costs?
So let me say that this is a matter that's currently being handled by the House Select and the Senate Select Intelligence Committees. So I would rather not answer that specific question other than just to tell you that Mr. Trump's desire to win would have him work with anyone.
Okay, so there you have Debbie Wasserman Schultz eagerly trying to pursue that collusion angle, and Cohen, saying that, it's not beyond him, I guess, but saying that he himself didn't seem to have any proof of collusion there. And in this whole Roger Stone versus Michael Cohen thing, Cohen has been convicted of lying to Congress. He's going to be, or pled guilty to it, and he's going to be going to jail for it. Roger Stone has been indicted for lying to Congress. So, it's, who do you believe in that? And but to underscore the issues that Republicans were raising about Cohen, Zach Anderson, tell us about Congressman Stube. He's from over in your neck of the woods, and his line of questioning.
Yeah, for our listeners who don't know Greg Stube, he's a hard-charging former state lawmaker from Sarasota. He's a young guy in his early 40s. And before he was elected to Congress, he was best known for pushing gun rights bills in the Florida legislature. He was for arming teachers before it became a big issue after Parkland. And so Stube was elected to Congress in November in a conservative district that includes southern Sarasota County. And he ran as a staunch Trump supporter, which is probably one reason why Republicans put him on this oversight committee to sort of push back against some of these Democratic investigations into the president. And Stube didn't disappoint his party yesterday. It was his first big moment, really, in the spotlight. And he went hard at Cohen, trying to undermine his credibility. He called him a convicted liar who has, quote, zero credibility. And he said, "I don't know a jury in America who would believe anything Mr. Cohen says, given his past actions." And I think we have a clip of what he said.
"Here we are taking testimony from a convicted liar and not someone who has just lied to his clients or family or friends, but testimony from an individual who deliberately and premeditatedly lies to his body. He lied to Congress through false statements and written statements. He lied to Congress through his testimony. He then amplified his false statements by releasing and repeating his lies to the public, including the other potential witnesses. Yet now, we on this committee and the American people are expected to believe Mr. Cohen's testimony. I don't know a juror in America who would believe anything Mr. Cohen says, given his past actions and lies."
All right, there you have Greg Stube echoing what a lot of other Republicans on the committee were saying throughout the day. The other significant Floridian in this is not on the oversight committee, although he did show up at the hearing, kind of reminiscent of the Frankie Pentangeli's brother scene in The Godfather 2. But Matt Gaetz, he is a congressman from the Panhandle. And Gaetz has been a big defender of President Trump. And Gaetz made some headlines on the eve of Cohen's testimony by tweeting. Let me quote this tweet that he sent out. He said, "Hey, Michael Cohen, do your wife and father-in-law know about your girlfriends? Maybe tonight would be a good time for that chat. I wonder if she'll remain faithful when you're in prison. She's about to learn a lot." That was a tweet that Gaetz put out there. A lot of people saw that as an effort to kind of ham-handed effort to intimidate a witness. And Gaetz, who's not known for backing off many things, apologized and deleted the tweet, said he wasn't meaning to intimidate anybody. Gaetz, though, could face some consequences for that. A fellow House member has asked the House Ethics Committee to look into his conduct. And the Florida Bar also reportedly is going to look into whether Gaetz violated Florida bar standards. You know, in addition to the focus on whether Trump was in any kind of legal jeopardy or Michael Cohen, you have now Gaetz could face some consequences from the whole from that whole spectacle. But let's move on. Also, though, next week, as we mentioned when Christine was talking about these human trafficking bills, next week the legislative session begins in Tallahassee. Tallahassee has been dominated for the last 2 months by the new governor, Ron DeSantis, making a lot of headlines. But there's going to be a lot of other political figures coming into town and taking some of the spotlight. John Kennedy, tell us a little bit about what to look for in the legislative session.
Well, that's it. It's going to be an adjustment for Governor Ron DeSantis. You know, he's been sort of a one-man show for the past, almost 2 months since he was sworn in January 8th. You know, DeSantis has been single-handedly, you know, firing off orders affecting schools, environmental policy, even the state's fight against the opioid crisis. He's also reached down into local governments. He suspended some high-profile officials. They included Broward Sheriff Scott Israel, Palm Beach County Election Supervisor Susan Booker, both of them for alleged misdeeds, Israel for his work on Parkland, and then Booker in her role in the elections last year that became kind of went off the rails in Palm Beach County. So for DeSantis, you know, it's good to be king, but starting on Tuesday, he's going to have to share the state with the legislature, and the two-month session begins with House Speaker Jose Oliva, Senate President Bill Galvano. These are two guys that have their own ideas about what are Florida's priorities, and a lot of times so do another 158 legislators. So DeSantis, he served three terms in Congress, so he knows a little bit what it's like in the legislature to a degree, but he's a first-time chief executive, so he's going to have to make his way around a lot of personalities, a lot of egos, and then all the policy matters that come pretty quickly during the session. DeSantis, one of his big priorities, of course, is, you know, he's pushing for $625 million to tackle the state's water problems, and he's overhauled water management districts that he saw as too close to the agriculture industry at the expense of the environment. And he's also proposed a $91.3 billion budget. That's the largest in state history, and that could cause him some problems, especially with the more tight spending House. Galvano and Oliva, they have their own agendas. Galvano wants to expand three major highways in Florida, an idea that sounds like it's taken from the 1950s, but which he says it's going to vastly improve the economy in many of the rural areas of the state. And Oliva, his thing is he's got a big menu of healthcare regulatory changes that he says will lower costs and maybe give the state's 2.6 million uninsured, maybe a better chance at care. So DeSantis has gotten early points from Democrats from his mostly for his environmental plans. He's also riding some fairly good approval ratings in the polls. So he's actually doing better now than he had as a candidate when he won the governor's race by less than 33,000 votes. But DeSantis's conservative stripes are undoubtedly going to inflame Democrats soon enough. He wants another private school voucher scholarship this year, which you know, is something that's always attacked by defenders of traditional public schools. And just this week, he came out in support of legislation banning sanctuary cities in Florida. This is the issue that would require that local governments cooperate with federal immigration officials seeking maybe to detain possibly undocumented residents. That idea is opposed by many Democratic allies, including immigrant advocates, religious organizations, and large portions of the Hispanic community in this state. So there'll be challenges for the new governor, and it's a lot easier when you're alone at the Capitol issuing executive orders. But sharing the stage and the power, that's going to be tough for everyone involved, and it all starts Tuesday.
All right. If you had to guess, John, what would you say is going to be the biggest potential point of conflict between DeSantis and the legislature?
I think maybe it's just coming up with money for the environmental projects and maybe the approach. I think you're going to hear some big defenders of agriculture in this legislature, which has historically kind of defaulted in favor of the sugar industry and vegetable growers across the state. Anything DeSantis wants to do that puts any kind of blame on agriculture runoff for the state's problem with water, I think is going to draw some criticism from a lot of legislators.
All right. We have discussed some of those issues in the past, so you want to just binge listen to the whole catalog of back episodes of the Inside Florida Politics podcast to prepare for the legislative session that begins next week, and we will have a lot more on that. But right now, I'm hearing that music again. It's funky and it's royalty-free, and it means it's time to return to our Pick a Number segment. So, note takers, you recall that I had the low number. I'll go first. My number was zero. Zero as in ground zero. That was the phrase that Governor Ron DeSantis used this week to describe human trafficking. He said that Florida is ground zero for trafficking. And I bring that number up because, as we mentioned, there seems to be some momentum to do something about human trafficking in the upcoming legislative session. Especially with it in the headlines now. As Christine pointed out, it's not as easy as it might seem, but you certainly have a lot of attention to it, and the governor seemingly on board with addressing the issue of human trafficking. Zach Anderson, your number was five. Tell us about that.
Yeah, George, we've talked a lot about red tide and other environmental problems on this show because it's been such a big issue in Florida politics. And there's a reason that it's commanded such attention. The red tide bloom was really, really, really bad last year. And state lawmakers got some details on just how bad it was during a meeting in Sarasota this week. The head of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission told a group of lawmakers from the Tampa Bay region that this recent red tide bloom was the fifth worst bloom of all time. He said that it would be on the Mount Rushmore of red tide blooms, if such a thing existed, which, you know, sounds kind of frightening. But this bloom lasted for 15 months, which it started in late 2017, went all the way through 2018. So that ranked at number five. The worst red tide bloom of all time was in 1994. It went all the way to 1997 and lasted 30 months. So, you know, this is going to be a big issue in the upcoming legislative session. There's a lot of bills talking about trying to reduce the amount of pollution that goes into waterways that contributes to red tide and other harmful algae blooms. And Governor DeSantis is talking about putting money towards solving some of these environmental problems. And there's a big reason for that. And that's because this was a really, really, really bad problem.
I like the idea that there's some guy ranking the red tide blooms, and he's got a top five list there. So very interesting number there. Christine Stapleton, 43.
Okay, 43 is the number of women that were elected to the Florida legislature last November. That's an unprecedented number of women, and it brings the total in the in both houses to 48, which is 30% of all lawmakers, elected lawmakers in Tallahassee are now women, which is a big jump and inches women closer to parity up in Tallahassee.
All right, 43, interesting number there. And now we got that one off the charts number from John Kennedy. We've all been waiting to hear what could that mean? 1,338.
Yeah, that whopping number is the number of general and local bills that have been filed for the legislative session, which, as we said, is beginning Tuesday. That number may rise a bit as final bills get filed and added to that number, but it's still likely to be down from last year. There were 1,719 filed last year. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it's not like the statute books have to be completely written when the session's over. And that's because if last year is any guide, only about 11% of the bills will actually pass both the House and Senate and go to the governor. Then it's up to the governor to let it become law or to veto them. Last year, Governor Scott went pretty light. He signed 193 bills into law last year, and he only vetoed two. So there we are. The session will have plenty of material to start with, but where it winds up is another story.
So 11% become law. So the over-under for political junkies is about 143 bills passing. So we'll make a note of that and see what happens at the end of the legislative session. Well, that brings to an end another Inside Florida Politics podcast. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. As always, it has been my honor to host this fine program with these talented journalists. I've been joined here in studio by Christine Stapleton of the Palm Beach Post, and from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy, and from Sarasota by Zach Anderson. He is the politics editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Here in West Palm Beach, I've been assisted by the indispensable Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano running all those sound clips. And of course, the digital audio production director for Gatehouse, weighing in from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Adam Fish. Thank you.